Welcome to the Word Theater Short Story Podcast, your weekly access to the best short stories read by great actors. My name is Cedaring Fox. I'm Word Theater's founder and artistic director. And together with Kirsty Peart, UK founder and creative partner, we have been producing live events featuring great actors and authors and bringing short stories to life in Los Angeles, New York, and London for 20 years. Today, we are sharing stories from a phenomenal London evening when Dame Harriet Walter, Guy Paul, Danny Sapani, and Emma Hamilton brought to life short stories by the prolific, prize-winning Irish-American author Brian Doyle, whose words, according to literary critic Renee Long, spill forth in jazzy, loose, fun-free patterns and swirls. Tragically, this late great author and essayist, whom Word Theater has loved since we first read him, passed away from brain cancer on May 27, 2017. And ever since I first read one of his prize-winning stories back in 2005, Word Theater has been on a mission to share his work with the world. Brian Doyle called his short prose poems, proems. They're surprisingly little gems that stay with you long after you've read them, and hearing them might be even better. I am thrilled to announce that we will be presenting an evening of all new selections of Brian Doyle stories at the Grammy Museum at LA Live on Thursday, June 1st, 2023, with an all-star cast that includes Alfred Molina, Laura Sangiacomo, and J.K. Simmons, and many more. So if you are anywhere near Los Angeles, please take the journey and join Brian's wife and his twin sons and me to experience this new batch of stories firsthand. You can read all about the amazing lineup and purchase tickets at wordtheater.org. And remember, if you can't be with us to experience our events live, you can join as a patron or enthusiast member, and a beautifully filmed version will be available for viewing within a week of the live event in your personal members area. So let's get on with the podcast. The first Brian Doyle story we have for you is A Surfing Story, performed by Danny Sapani.
I'll tell you a surfing story. And this is a rare surf story that has no oceans or surfboards in it. Because it's about a guy who spent almost his whole life surfing situations and relationships. Never falling in, never over his head, never breathless, always on top of the situation and never of it. Do you know what I mean? And he got almost to the end of his life without ever getting his feet wet. And then, as so often is the case when we talk about hearts being startled awake, it was a kid who knocked him off his board and into the sea, where hearts get hammered and startled and shivered and whole. But I get ahead of myself. The guy's name was Pete. He had been a terrific athlete as a kid. And then he had a terrific hand with money and investments. He made boatloads of money. Lots of girls, traveled everywhere, did every dashing thing you can imagine. But after a while, even the coolest girls would gently disentangle themselves because, as one of them said, with real affection, you never get tangled, Pete. And in the end, we see that you just don't want to bother. And even someone who just wants to have fun can't stay long. Do you know what I mean? He did know what she meant too, which is what stung. He got all the way to 50 like this, looking cool on the outside and not getting birthday cards from anyone. And no one except the doorman at his condo knowing when he was sick with the flu. And finally, he sold his condo in Boston and bagged his lucrative Master of the Universe job and moved to Poipu and bought a condo on the beach and spent his time paddle surfing, but nothing really changed. And he had girls, but no lovers, and companions, but no friends. Finally, what happened was he was driving drunk and he got busted. And during the whole process of getting that fixed, he met a detective who showed him the world of meth babies, kids whose parents were addicts and dumped them or burned them with cigarettes and dangled them from highway overpasses and evil shit like that. And there was this kid named Kimmo. He was 4, and both parents dead in a meth explosion. And this kid says to Pete one day at the cop orphanage, "How come you never look at me with both of your eyes?" And Pete says, that was the moment when everything cracked. He says it wasn't like in the movies where there's swelling music and the lights get brighter. In fact, he said he wanted to slap the kid for being so rude, but he didn't. And eventually, he adopted Kimmo. It's a long story. There's no happy ending because they argue like hell. And neither one of them can cook worth 2 cents as yet. And Kimmo just got his face tattooed like a Maori for some reason, which sent Pete into a fit like you read about. But he's not surfing anymore. That's the point. You know what I mean?
The second Brian Doyle story we have for you is Finger of Speech, and it is performed by Emma Hamilton.
A finger of speech, as one of my young sons says at the table one day, superciliously. That's a finger of speech, to his twin brother, sneeringly defining a metaphor that just floated by. And away goes Mum's brain, sliding right off the table, past the ketchup and off into space, where I contemplate the essential accuracy of this remark. For indeed, there are fingers of speech, aren't there? The middle finger of speech, used so very often in many offensive and defiant and enraged manners. And the index finger of speech, indicating primacy or direction, or if being wagged angrily, denial or disapproval. And the last finger of speech, accusatory or indicatory of prissiness. The left ring finger of speech, indicating marital status. The thumbs up and thumbs down of speech, indicating approval, direction, a Tony Robbins cowgirl heroine, or that you would very much appreciate a lift into town. And then there are fingers of speech in endless combinations, such as the thumb and forefinger indicating loserness, and the index and pinky combo advertising a rabid affection for the University of Texas, or gang affiliation. It's really the same thing. The circled fingers of zero. The circle and ruffled coxcomb that says, okay. The number of fingers brandish to number the items under discussion. The forefinger and thumb pistols that people point at each other for no good reason. The fingered V of victory. Or peace. The massed ranks of fingers pressed together in prayer and supplication. The ordered ranks of fingers telling motorists to stop. The peremptory forefinger summoning a taxicab. The fingered triad by which we swear fealty or the Boy Scout oath. The split fingers of the Vulcan salute, by which we live long and prosper. The motley parade of fingers playing, here's the church and here's the steeple, open the doors and there's all the people, to a child agog. And there are so many more digitous communications, Not to mention the millions of people who speak with their hands in sign languages of endless shapes and sorts. Among them, interestingly, a language called baby sign, by which infants can communicate before they've learned to manipulate their magical tongues to form words with their mouths. And then there are the thousands of infinitesimal gestures and shivers and flutters and flickers of fingers individually and collectively that deliver messages by punch or caress, touch and poke, thump and knuckle. And then there are the eloquent messages of hands at rest, flung or folded, holding a steaming cup, waiting patiently on nervous knees at the doctor's office, patient and still on the tiny chest of a child with a fever. And so we circle back to my sons at the table. Boys who were once tiny children with fevers, and worse, on whom my hands rested worried a thousand nights and more. But now their hands are fleshy comets and bony shoulders, one son insisting on his linguistic prowess, and the other insisting he is a doofus, and that there is no such thing as a finger of speech. Ask Mom! Which they do. And I tell them that they are both right, which, as usual, does not settle their seething. But I use a forefinger to indicate where they can take their debate and shuffle off to my desk and sit down to make a note on the mystery of the matter, my fingers stooping on the story like hawks.
The third Brian Doyle story we have for you is Sakil the Tailor, and it is performed by Guy Paul.
Another time, I was talking to Sakil the Tailor in Boston, whose shop on Chauncey Street was essentially a door with a vast and impenetrable space behind it, a wilderness known only to Sakil, who never moved from his stool during working hours. And we got to talking all metaphysical, as he said, about his work. "Now, what you see of my work is tactile," he said. "Pants, jackets, buttons, zippers, the occasional nice shirt, although not in your case, your shirts are a despair to me and very probably to your poor mother, if only she knew. Whereas what I sometimes think my work is holes. Do you know what I'm saying? A young man like you comes to me because a seam has burst in his jacket. And well, it should burst. Such a shoddy workmanship I have not seen since I was a boy in the ancient and long ago. I repair the hole. I vanish the hole, you see? So my work is vanishing holes. Holes present themselves, like that hole in the breast pocket of this awful shirt you are for some reason wearing today. What is that, Egyptian cotton? Why does someone wear such a thing? I mean, what it might be a good thing for a man working in the cotton fields near Alexandria, but in Boston, I don't think so. What I'm saying is that holes come and I make them go. I am in the business of closing holes. If all was well, if all things kept their composition, then I would have no work. But that is not the way of the world. The way of the world is that holes open, not just in battered old suit jackets that mismatch their pants like some young men I know who go about the streets wearing for reasons that elude me, but in marriages and civilizations and tribes and clans. You can wonder, as I often have, why holes open? Why is the design of a universe in which things fall apart? But then I remember that the work is to repair the holes, to make whole that which has flown apart. You see what I'm saying? You smile, but I can see you understand. You are the newspaper fellow collecting stories. I am only a tailor. But think, All the stories you collect in the newspaper are essentially cut from the same cloth. Each one is, in one way or another, a story of a hole opening or a hole being closed. A criminal, such as, for example, Mayor John Bernard Hines of Boston, can wipe out my entire neighborhood with the stroke of a pen. You report this in your newspaper as news, but really, he opens a hole. You see? And there are many people striving to heal the hole. And there are many ways to heal holes. Now, some people will say that the effort to heal holes is itself good, but I do not agree. If I tried to repair a hole in your battered old suit jacket, for example, but did not exactly do so, what good is that? You would still be jaunting about with a hole the size of a quarter, gaping in your seam, embarrassing yourself and everyone you meet, a nice young man with a newspaper, but a hole in his jacket, not to mention it does not match the pants. And this is why you are going to leave your poor jacket with me this afternoon, and I will repair the hole, and the universe will be slightly better off. A tailor cannot, in 1 hour, repair a hole the size of the entire West End of Boston, but he can certainly vanish a hole the size of a quarter. What kind of a tailor would he be if he couldn't do that? Just leave it on the counter. I hope your poor mother will not see her son walking back to the newspaper office in nothing but his awful shirt of Egyptian cotton without even this battered old suit jacket that does not match the pants. It is a good thing your pants do not have holes that I can see. And if they do have holes, do me the great favor of not telling me about it today. A man can only repair so many holes in one day, and just imagine what it is like for me, a professional of long standing, to have to watch you walk away in that awful shirt of Egyptian cotton for all the world to see. I avert my eyes. Come back before 4 for your jacket.
And the final Brian Doyle story we have on today's podcast that was recorded live in London is called Room 2, and it is performed by Harriet Walter.
Weirdly enough, the one time I was ever lured into a karaoke bar by an office event I could not afford to miss, there, in Room 2, was Mr. Kim. Singing his heart out, the door shut tight. The way karaoke bars work is that you can either sing with other people and laugh your ass off at how terrible or impassioned your companions are, or you can sing alone, for whatever reasons you want to sing alone. And there, in Room 2, to my absolute amazement, was Mr. Kim singing alone. The very concept of Mr. Kim being in a karaoke bar was so wild and implausible that I went back to the door several times to be absolutely sure. And by God, it was indeed Mr. Kim. Although he was not wearing his usual baker's smock, nor the black suit and black cap he occasionally wore if he was attending a wedding or a wake after work. He was actually wearing a T-shirt, which was unthinkable to Mr. Kim. I was relieved to see he was not wearing jeans, which would have sprained my eyeballs permanently, I think. The shirt was outré enough. The very idea of Mr. Kim in jeans rather than his meticulous old man pants, as my kids called his pressed trousers, would fry the synapses of anyone who had seen the man week after week for many years in the bakery, as I had. In a karaoke bar, you can sing any of thousands of songs for which a machine provides the music and a large television screen scrolls the lyrics. I was most curious to see what song Mr. Kim was singing with all his might. Something from the old country, perhaps, which might give me a hint of just what old country Mr. Kim was from, a question he never answered. A love song? Giving a hint of who or what he loved. A drinking song? A country song? A glam rocker? But I could not see the screen from where I stood by the door of room 2, and the booths were all soundproof. I could ask the bartender, perhaps. There must be a central console from which the owners or attendants could monitor the booths, but this seemed intrusive, even for a journalist. And perhaps there is a code of privacy at karaoke bars, for all I know. But just as I stepped away from the door, surrendering all hope of ever discovering the song Mr. Kim was singing, the door opened suddenly, and there was Mr. Kim, glaring at me. For those of you who know Mr. Kim, you will know the weight of this moment. Mr. Kim could be rude and terse and blunt and challenging at the best of times, and it was no stretch to imagine him vituperative and furious at having been seen in a private moment. But once again, he did the unexpected. You never could predict or assume his behavior, and he gently took me by the elbow and drew me into room 2. "You wish to know what song I was singing," he said. And to my surprise and relief, his voice was friendly and even gentle. "I will tell you, or better, I will sing it again. It is the most beautiful song in the history of the world. I sing no other song. I sing this song when I'm low and weary. It brings me back up to balance. It restores something in me. I would guess you know what I mean. I would guess there are songs like this for you. I think perhaps everyone has songs like this when they are low. You can sing the song anywhere, anyhow, of course, but I find this way the best way, at least for me. Something about the amplification, perhaps, or the privacy. When you sing at home or in the shop, people hear you singing, and they think they know something about you, and from the song you sing, or something about you because you are singing. But this is not so. No one knows anything about anyone. We think we do, but it is an illusion. It's just that sometimes all you can do is sing your song. So I come here to sing my song. You will not tell anyone about this. I'm sure I can trust you to forget that we had this conversation. I do not need to bribe you with bread and pies. I will trust you and your good judgment in this, even though you are a journalist. He spoke with a kind of honest passion I had not seen in him before, a sort of revelation that was highly uncharacteristic of him. He was one of the most private and tightly wound men I had ever met, despite his occasional silent kindness and generosity, which he would vehemently deny for murky reasons if you tried to thank him for it. I'd seen this happen many times and puzzled over it, but perhaps Mr. Kim was right that no one really knows anything about anyone in the end. We get and we give hints and intimations. Perhaps that's the best we can do. I didn't say anything, there being nothing to say. And also, I've learned in my years as a journalist that sometimes silence is productive, and not every lull in the conversation needs filling. Mr. Kim stared at me for a moment, clearly mulling something over in his head, and then he said, "Here, listen, I will sing the song, and then you will forget this conversation and the song I sang and the fact that I sang it. Now, I know you are a journalist and you will want to write this down someday, but I'm sure I can trust you not to do so until I am gone, one way or another, either from life or from the shop. Put it this way, when you have no idea where I am in life or in death, then you can write it down." And with that, he punched a button and the music began. Lean, clean, piano notes. But I could not place the melody. And then Mr. Kim closed his eyes and began to sing. All the rest of my life, I'll remember that moment. Beyond all expectation, so far beyond imagining that the word shock doesn't even come close, Mr. Kim had the most beautiful, high, liquid, wavering, shivering tenor voice I had ever heard. And he sang from the bottom of his soul, with every iota of his being. He sang the whole song through as I stood there so moved I could not speak. And then he punched the button again and the music stopped. And that was the end of that. Sometimes even now when he's long gone, his shop shuttered for a while and then leased anew as a jazzercise studio, I sometimes hear that song on the radio, or shivering from someone's car, or even reaching me from a doorway. This last happened a few days ago as I walked past a theater. And I turned and I walked in, and I stood in the lobby, listening until the whole song was done. To my absolute amazement, I found myself weeping. I love you, Porgy. Don't let him take me. Don't let him handle me and drive me mad. If you can keep me, I want to stay with you forever. And I'll be glad.
We hope you've enjoyed these four stories by Brian Doyle, performed by Danny Sapani, Emma Hamilton, Guy Paul, and Harriet Walter, live in London. You can find Brian's books at bookshop.org/shop/wordtheater or ukbookshop.org/shop/wordtheater/. And if you're anywhere near Los Angeles on Thursday, June 1st, please come meet us at the Grammy Museum at LA Live for what promises to be an unforgettable evening of new selections of Brian Doyle's stories. 2023 marks the 20th anniversary of Word Theater, and we have many in-person events scheduled, which patrons and enthusiasts can access online from anywhere in the world, from the comfort of your home. Visit our website at wordtheater.org to see how you can support this podcast by becoming a Word Theater patron or enthusiast member. That's it for this week. Next week, we have a Ha Jin story performed by Sung Kang, who stars in the Fast and the Furious franchise. So tune in and tell your friends. Also, if you like what you're hearing, please send us an email to admin@wordtheater.org. We'd love your feedback. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please write us a review. Thanks for listening. Special thanks to Jonathan Sachs for composing our theme music. Thanks to Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture for their continuing support. And a big shout out to Jason Lee, our podcast editor. This is Cedaring Fox in Los Angeles. Until next week, signing off.